All right, so a quick story. I finished preaching at Lima Camp this year. And Brother Bob Kuhlman, whom I love very, very much, comes up to me and he says, "Great job, man." You know, just typical fashion, very encouraging. "Great job. Really appreciated the message." And then he kind of chuckles and he's like, "I really liked hearing the illustrations a second time." I'm like, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Well, you know, I like to listen to the messages on our website, and you use some of the same illustrations you did last year." So outwardly, of course, I laugh with him and convey that, you know, that's fine. And inside, I'm mortified. And go back to Jeremy and Jackie's, and the first thing I do is start pulling up my sermons from the prior years. And my plan was to listen to my whole sermon from the prior year, but I didn't make it that far because in 2017, this year, I got up and made a comment similar to, "I love being in Lima because you guys are authentic, real Christians." So I turn on my 2016 sermon and I say, "I love being in Lima. You guys are true, authentic, real Christians." So I click on my 2015 sermon. "Thank you for having me to Lima. I always tell people you guys are authentic, real Christians." 2014, authentic, real Christians. So I'm making a public proclamation that ship has sailed. You will receive no such encouragement from me ever again. And now on to my sermon. When he told me that, because I think you said I used the B thing a couple times, you know. My brain works in that fact. I haven't used that at all at home. But for some reason, I get into a different environment and things come to mind. And so, you know, they say what? The listener retains 25% of what they hear. So I can preach it four times and until it sinks in. Yeah. 1 John chapter 2. And it's actually verse 15. For some reason, my autocorrect didn't pick that up when I texted Marshall. I put chapter 2, verse 14. But 1 John's an awesome book. If I understand, are the students in the school working on memorizing that this year? Really cool book. We've been working on memorizing that at our assembly during our memorization class. A lot of good stuff, good passages. And don't want to jump around too much today. Just want to give you guys some thoughts. And in verse 15, we're told, "Do not love the world, nor the things that are in the world. For if anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, and the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life, is not from the Father, but it's from the world. And the world is passing away, and also its lust, but the one who does the will of God lives forever." 1 John is a really neat book because it's, you know, I was first drawn to it by Bill Compton out in Oregon because he started preaching on the concept of love as a Christian, and he said 3 years later he wasn't done. You know, he kept preaching on that concept, and 1 John is excellent for that because he spends so much time really identifying what love is as the Christian and what love for God and love for brethren looks like. And he's been doing that all the way up until this point. But he sort of takes a step aside. You know, it's like he's been saying, this is what it should look like. This is what your life should look like. This is what your actions should look like. But he stops for a moment and says, just to be clear, this is what it shouldn't look like. And here he says, if you love the world, the love of the Father is not in you. He instantly states that the very concepts are completely contrary and opposing. Okay? Can't have the love of the Father if you have the love of the world. Because everything that comes from the world or originates from the world doesn't come from the Father. The lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, boastful pride of life. And I think that's important sometimes to, you know, it's you know, we as Christians have been presented with this great and wonderful message and empowering potential in the New Testament, and that is really what drives us, right? That's what gives us the power and the capability to accomplish what we can accomplish to God's glory in this life. But it doesn't hurt at times to do a quick check and make sure, you know, when I shine the light of the Scripture on my life, is there anything out of place? Is there anything that maybe is off kilter a little bit? I managed a bank for about 6 years, and you know, with banks, compliance is huge. I mean, there's all types of regulatory agencies that are always going to be there. And whenever you're part of a large corporate bank, it's usually very unlikely that a regulatory agency is going to show up at a branch in Connersville, Indiana. So large banks have these internal departments that are there to make sure, you know, trickle down and branch out to make sure all branches are acting in compliance. And you know, when you're a branch manager and functioning the branch, especially in a bank that is very sales oriented, you're always trying to keep in your mind as well, we want to make sure and do things in accordance with regulatory statutes. We want to make sure we're in place, because we know that about every 18 months, we're going to pull in the parking lot one morning and the auditor is going to be there, the internal company auditor who operates as a ghost in the company. No one knows when she's coming or what her schedule is, but she shows up in order to audit your branch to see how you're performing. So in between those 18-month periods, there is a department devoted to getting you prepared for that, you know, that surprise audit. So those individuals are usually there maybe every 3 months, and they do checkups. You know, it's almost like going to the doctor and checking up on stuff. And, you know, what they do is they take a cross-section of everything that you've done. They take a cross-section of the transactions that have been done. They, you know, if you've opened 50 accounts since the last time they were there, they grabbed three of them randomly. They grab a couple business accounts. They grab deposit box entrance cards and all these things. You know, they kind of hover around the teller line and watch for behaviors and all these things. And they do kind of a miniature little pretend audit. Well, I had a banker working for me that had been with the bank for about 33 years. She had been through 6 different mergers, had about as much tenure as you can imagine. And it never ceased to amaze me that every time it seemed like we had a checkup, they would say, hey, we just want to let you know this is supposed to be done this way. And Barb was an excellent sport, but Barb was like, I have never heard that before, ever, until now. Never have I heard that. You know, I've been doing it this way for 30-some years. And ironically, that had not shown up in the scope of any prior audit, any prior checkup. But it was something that pointed out to her, and she would change the behavior, you know, change it to match what the bank wanted. And, you know, sometimes I kind of think, not sometimes, really, that's really what John is getting at here. He says, I just want to make sure, you know, we're talking about love of the brethren and love of God and what that entails. But it doesn't go without saying that along with that, we shouldn't love the world. Shouldn't love the world. You know, love of the brethren, to me, is always most clearly defined in Philippians chapter 2, in a passage that doesn't even use the word love, that we're told with humility we regard one another as more important than ourselves. That defines love to me. That is at its most base form, when you decide to put an individual and everything that is vital for them spiritually and physically above your own needs and your own priorities. Love of God, we see very very clearly in Scripture then, is to follow His commands, to walk the path that He would have us walk. That is how we demonstrate love to God. Well, here John talks about the love of the world, and to me, whenever you look at this passage and the context here, love of the world really is to take these items that these warnings that he gives, and to put those above all else. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the boastful pride of life. When I begin to take those, and those rise in importance and rise in priority in my life above the souls of men, above the path that God would have me walk, above His commands, above all these spiritual things, when those begin to rise above, I'm now moving to the point of loving the world. And that's what John is warning against here. And you know, I think a message like this can seem very elementary, but it's the very thing, you know, we talk about the conflict between the flesh and the spirit. And I don't know about you guys, almost every time I ever think of that conflict, I think of us striving against the temptation of sin. That's what it is, you know. The spirit striving against the flesh. The spirit doesn't want to sin, and the flesh wants to self-fulfill, and that's what we're talking about. But guys, it's not just that. It's the very motive with which we live our lives every single day that's the struggle. It's not that moment when we're faced with the temptation and that battle occurs. It's every single moment of every single day when we wake up and we begin to set our priorities for the day. And we begin to decide what we love and what we're going to put first. That happens all the time. And I think that's important for us to recognize why John, you know, John says, do not love the world. Because the things from the world that may tempt you to love or acquire your love don't originate from God. They're contrary to God's will. Has anyone here seen the Founder? Just a couple last night? This will ring pretty true then, okay? Just a couple? Okay, that's good, because otherwise you probably could leave, because you wouldn't need to hear my sermon. But The Founder I thought was really, really neat. It's got Michael Keaton in it, and it is about a guy named Ray Kroc. And Ray Kroc was a gentleman that, you know, he was known amongst his peers and amongst his family as wanting to be a part of something big. He wanted to be involved with something that really took off and really established success in his life because he hadn't really had it. And at the beginning of the movie, and I mean, I'll tell you the gist, but I won't ruin it like Andy did this morning. You know, I won't really ruin anything. It's still worth watching. But at the beginning of the movie, you know, Ray Kroc is traveling all over the place, I think over the Midwest for the most part, and he's trying to sell a milkshake machine that can do 5 milkshakes simultaneously. And he's not having a lot of luck because restaurants don't need 5 milkshakes at one time. They need 1 milkshake. But it's the current idea that he really grasped on that he just thought was going to be fantastic, you know. Well, as he's traveling around, he's constantly frustrated by having to stop at the common fast food restaurant style at the time, which was the drive-in diner, okay? He would drive in, and he'd have to wait forever on his food, and then the person who would bring his food would forget something, and as a salesman working on commission, he was just constantly frustrated because he would realize how much time he was spending there. Well, he gets a phone call one day from an individual that he had pitched his machine to and kind of expected the same outcome. And the gentleman called and said, hey, are you still selling those particular machines? And he said, yes. And he said, well, we'd like to order 4 of them. And Ray Kroc's like, he says on the phone, I don't think you understand what the machine does. The machine makes 5 milkshakes at the same time. There's no way you have to make 16 milkshakes simultaneously. And the guy on the phone says, you know what, make it 5. So Ray Kroc is confused and interested. So he actually drives almost all the way across the country to San Bernardino, California, to go to this restaurant. And that's when he meets the McDonald's brothers. And the McDonald's brothers have a restaurant. And, you know, Ray Kroc walks up there and he sees this line of people going up to a window to get food. So he sits in his car for a little bit and ends up asking someone, what am I supposed to do? And they say, well, just get in line. You know, it moves pretty fast. So he moves up the line pretty quickly, and he gets up there, and he orders his food. Well, in 10 seconds, they set it down in front of him. And he says, what is this? You know, I ordered that up there. And the guy's like, yeah, I understand. It's right here. This is your food. And so Ray Kroc's like, where do I eat it? you know, where's the plates and the silverware and stuff? And the guy's like, you don't need any of that. It's wrapped up in paper, and you just throw the paper away when you're done. You can eat it anywhere you want. You can go eat it in your car or whatever. And he sits down to eat it, is really impressed with the food, tastes really good. So he wants to meet, you know, these owners. And he ends up meeting the McDonald's brothers. And he asks the McDonald's brothers to give him their story. How in the world did you come up with this? And the McDonald's brothers, for all intents and purposes, for my basic research on this, pretty much invented modern fast food in a lot of ways. They took the assembly line concept and applied it to a restaurant, is what they did. And they showed Ray Kroc that. They said, we actually got out in a parking lot and drew out our restaurant in chalk and had our staff perform. And they said they worked, I can't remember the movie, all day or multiple days redesigning their kitchen in chalk until it was this beautiful dance, you know, this ballet of their employees being able to produce food so quickly. Well, the McDonald's brothers were perfectly happy. Their business was making money and functioning fine. Ray Kroc did have a kind of a salesman's mentality. And he ends up ultimately convincing them to sign him in ways as an agent to franchise this business. Okay? So Ray Kroc, that's what the movie largely is about. It's about the individual credited with franchising McDonald's. And through the course of the movie, you know, he deals with different hurdles here and there and everything. You know, he even goes as far as to mortgage his house at one point to try to really spur along this effort to franchise the businesses. You know, through the course of the movie, there's a lot of trial there. And, you know, I do like that they put in the movie. This is a little quiz question, and the people who've seen the movie can't answer, but as a business person, this interested me. Does anyone know, if I were to ask you how McDonald's makes their money, what would your guess be? Soft drinks? Nope. Sounds too obvious, right? French fries? Nope. McDonald's gets the bulk of their revenue through real estate. And they show that in the movie, because Ray Kroc is going broke because the franchise fees that people pay him aren't enough to even make a living. It hardly gives him anything, hardly goes back to the McDonald's brothers at all. Well, an attorney ends up presenting the guy with the idea, instead of having the franchisees buy property and build their building, you buy the property and have them lease it from you forever. So McDonald's actually, to this day, they're one of the highest holders of real estate in the world, because every single McDonald's you see sits on land that's owned by McDonald's. And those franchisees pay a lease to them. That's how they make Now, of course, the hamburgers have to be good or it wouldn't be worth that much. But that's where they actually make all their money, is from those leases. So they kind of show that in the movie. And Ray Kroc, you know, figures that out. And suddenly Ray Kroc begins to get pretty wealthy there. And, you know, if you look up Ray Kroc, you know, online or wherever, he is considered a great innovator. Ray Kroc is considered someone who took something from nothing. He took an idea, and he applied his blood, sweat, and tears to it. Ray Kroc died with a net worth of about $500 million. Okay, you know, his wife, whenever he died, was known as a great philanthropist. And you don't really find a lot negative about the guy whenever you do research. Well, the movie had some interesting details, you know. First of all, Ray Kroc pursues one of the wives of his franchisees while he's married, and actually ended up eventually marrying that woman. Ray Kroc divorced his wife because his wife simply wanted to be a wife, and I thought from the movie, seemed to want to have a simple life with her husband, but she wasn't innovative enough to match him. So he divorced her. You know, through the course of the movie, keep in mind that he was contracted by the McDonald's brothers and was very limited on things, decisions that he could make and things that he could do. He began to step outside the realm of that contract at the disagreement of the McDonald's brothers. And it got to the point where after he had figured out the real estate thing, he established a corporation and called it the McDonald's Corporation. And that's the corporation that would purchase all the land. And whenever the McDonald's brothers, this was sort of the culmination of all the problems, and the McDonald's brothers called him and said, "You can't do this. This is in violation of the contract, and we'll have to sue you." And he said, "Go ahead and try. You can't afford it. You can't afford to sue me. I'm wealthy enough now that I'll bury you in legal fees and legal process for years and years to come. There's nothing you can do about it." So he shows up to them shortly afterwards, and he hands the McDonald's brothers a blank check. And they're rather insulted and say, "What is this?" And he says, "You know what that is. Just write out the amount so I can buy officially buy the business from you so we can sever ties." So they come to an agreement of what he will pay for that, and they show up to the closing table. And the buy-off includes a specific price, and it includes 1% royalty to the McDonald's brothers of all McDonald's profit forever. And Ray Kroc explains at the closing table, he says, "Listen, everything on this is contractually fine, but I have investors that have a problem with the 1%, so we have to do that on a handshake basis." And in the movie, they do an excellent job of really dramatizing that he stands up and says, "Guys, you're going to get your money. You're going to get your 1% forever." And he shakes the hands of the McDonald's brothers. Well, shortly after that, he has his attorney go to the McDonald's brothers and forces them to change the name of their restaurant. Keep in mind, they started the food, the recipes, the system. Makes them change their name because he has bought the intellectual property that is McDonald's. Okay? A few years later, he actually opens up a McDonald's right across the street in San Bernardino, California, and puts them out of business. Furthermore, the McDonald's brothers, the McDonald's family, never saw a dime of the 1% in perpetuity that was promised at the closing table. Does anyone have an idea what that'd be worth today? It's about $100 million a year. Family didn't see any of it. You know, the world says he is a successful, accomplished innovator. He is someone to be mimicked and to be admired. And guys, the story is the same in almost any worldly successful individual you look at, most of them. You know, their life may have heralds that proclaim their worldly success and their status, and their achievement. But if you start to just dig an inch deep into their personal lives, they've had problems with relationships, they've had problems with children, with marriages. Just like Andy pointed out perfectly this morning, it doesn't take that long to really see a void there, to see that they're missing something. And Ray Kroc is no different. He embraced the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the boastful pride of life. Embraced it. But anything that was spiritual, anything that was relational in any way, went to the wayside. You know, guys, it's important for us. I don't know if any of us are going to, accomplish franchising the next McDonald's or anything. You know, I don't think any of us are out to do that. But it can be so much more subtle than that. If you look at these three items, only one deals with the pride of accomplishment. The other two are about the pursuit. You know, I think it's easy sometimes for a lot of us in Christ Church, you know, we're told in Scripture that God chose the poor of the world to be rich. He chose us. That I don't think we've really got any, billionaires sitting here today. He chose us. People that are authentic and real, in the world, that are part of the world to accomplish great spiritual things for Him. But I think it's easy for us to sometimes to look at passages like, the love of money is the root of all evil. Well, that's no problem because I don't have any. Well, it's not the possession of the money, it's the love and the pursuit of the money. John here is warning against the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes. And then whenever you've reached a level of accomplishment, and whatever that may be, then comes along the boastful pride of life. But the lust is that desire to pursue. And I think it's important for us to always consider again, what is the motive with which I'm doing this? Why am I pursuing this? Why am I steering my family this direction? Why am I steering my spouse this direction? Why am I teaching my children? Why am I doing this thing that at face value seems very godly and very charitable, you know? I don't want to cast judgment upon Ray Kroc's wife, the great philanthropist, but she was a married woman who ended up divorcing her husband for another man. I can't help but wonder how much money she would have had to give away to charity if the McDonald's brothers would have been paid their $100 million a year. You know, I mean, but seen as a great philanthropist. You know, I've been part of local civic organizations, you know, Lions Club, or, you know, all those that, I don't know what other ones you got up here. You've probably got, I know that we have Optimist Club, we have JC's, we have Rotary and all those things. You know, those organizations are typically, in my opinion, organizations of good people doing good things. And the mantra of the organization is very selfless. They want to try to raise money, and that money goes to a cause. It goes to a community, or it goes to something like that. Even in those things, just like in our spiritual walk, we need to ask ourselves what our motive is. Because I encountered a lot of individuals in those clubs that their motive was to make themselves feel good. That was the ultimate motive with which they drove that type of activity. Now, it wasn't my responsibility to speak to them about that. It was their responsibility to identify the why. Why am I doing this? That's what John's trying to show here, is that you got to be careful that if these things start to move up in priority and ultimately become the object of your love, your decision to commit yourself to those things, you're drifting away from the point. You're drifting away from the process. It's the same with those individuals in Matthew chapter 7 that received the judgment there on judgment day. I didn't know you. You practiced lawlessness. It doesn't matter if you cast out demons in my name and performed miracles in my name and performed acts of righteousness in my name. You know, your motive and your intent was self-serving and self-satisfying. So we need to be careful of those things. We need to be careful of those pursuits, because our objective needs to be spiritual. You know, I look at the passage in Hebrews where Abraham is described as an alien in a foreign land. Do you truly see yourself that way, Christian? Are you an alien in a former land or in a foreign land, or are you just thriving within good old America as an American? You know, I've had the blessing to go to Belarus a number of times, and I'm a very analytical person that wants to know how everything works. I'm working feverishly on learning the language, which is really hard, you know, but everything still seems foreign to me. You know, when I learn something about their design of government, their design of business, their design, you know, the way they personally live their lives, everything seems foreign because I'm an American. You know, you grow up in the United States of America with the idea of this is the way we do things. This is the way it happens. So you go to a foreign country and you're kind of engulfed with that feeling of, man, I'm really a stranger here. I'm really an alien here, man. I feel like the guy in the flying saucer that comes down and doesn't know how things work because things are so different. Do you feel that way in this world? You should. Do you feel like, man, I just feel like stuff here, you know, I hear stories like that with that guy, and I mean, that just, man, that's so foreign to what I want to be and what I know God wants me to be. You know, God tells us in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, he took the wisdom of the world and its foolishness to the world, God's wisdom is foolishness. So he took the foolishness of the message in order to have an impact. You know, the completely contrary. Does that mean that achievement in the world is inherently wrong or sinful? No, it's mind, it's brain, it's where are you at? Why are you pursuing what you're pursuing? Why are you going after what you're going after? You know, what's your motive? What's the end goal? What are you striving to accomplish here? Everything we should do should be to God's glory. Everything. It's you know, you guys have heard the phrase, what it's more about the race than the finish. You know, it's that's so much that applies so well to the concept of Christianity, that this is about the walk. We have to ask ourselves, why are we doing what we are doing? Are we, with humility of mind regarding one another as more important than ourselves, considering in every circumstance their spiritual well-being, their souls, the souls impacted by my participation, by my self-sacrifice? Or does that begin to shift to, man, this, I would feel good if we did this today. I would feel pretty good. You know, this would be a good end to a hard week, you know. I didn't do it with you guys today. You know, I didn't want you to have someone, a guest speaker, come in and start passing out like a test, but I did this at our assembly one time where I did a sermon similar to this, and I passed out little pieces of paper that had the things that we do in life on it. You know, it had job, family activities, you know, leisure activities, you know, like fellowship with the brethren, individual godly activity, like Bible reading, prayer. And I started out the sermon, I didn't collect these, but I said, I want you to write your priorities down. Just number them, you know, 1 to 8. What's your number one priority? Well, at the end of the sermon, I said, right next to that, I want you to write out in order what you commit the most time to. And it doesn't match up. A lot of cases, it doesn't match. You know, in our mind, we set the priority, but our level of commitment and our level of time sometimes doesn't match up. You know, working a job is an important thing. It's a vital thing. It has to happen. But again, what are we doing during that time? What are we trying to accomplish? What's our motivation? Are we doing everything we can to love the brethren and to love God and to love the souls of men? Whenever we can. Or does a lot of time fit in there that's really self-satisfying and gives us this boastful pride of life, this accomplishment within this world? You know, our accomplishments here should be pretty much nil. I mean, there's really nothing here. You know, you look at people like Paul, who had reached a level of accomplishment in the world, within the religious community that he was in. He was, and I love the passage where he hauls off and says, buddy, you want to talk about accomplishments in the flesh? Here's my resume. And he shunned all that. He threw all that away because he recognized that all mean nothing in the work of Christ. Absolutely meant nothing. You know, 1 John is an awesome book. He moves on from here really again to continue that encouragement to us to love one another, not with word or with tongue, but in deed and in truth. He ends up defining what love is. You know, as we understand love, because Christ came in the flesh and died for us. That's the whole way we understand what love is. It is that self-sacrifice for the souls of men, for the people that surround us. And that's the motivation, guys, that drives us every single day. And I want to encourage you that let that drive you every single day, but take the time to ask the question. Take the time to think about, you know, as you are in the midst of your pursuits, don't be like that rich man in James that fades away like flowering grass. In the midst of his pursuits, he fades away. Make sure that every aspect of your pursuits has a godly focus, has a godly intent, and hopefully has a spiritual reward, not for our glory, but for God's glory. Hopefully has an impact on the souls of men. Hopefully brings glory and honor to God our Father. through our behavior and through our character. And as you're doing that, these things aren't going to be temptations. They're not going to be hard things to avoid. But, you know, we live in a world that the world shows us that these are the important things. And it can become so subtle. So subtle. We live in a society, guys, where education, sports, leisurely activities, a sense of accomplishment that you have worked hard and deserve a rest. You know, these type of principles are edged into the American ideal, and they are contrary to God's will. We don't rest now. There's nothing about a rest now. Hebrews defines our rest as when we get to leave this place and be in glory with God. That's our rest. Here, we labor with love for the Master. That's what we get to do. And our attitude while we do that is truly what will have an impact on people. That's what will see the difference. You know, that was really hard for me growing up in the church and wondering, man, there is a church on every corner, all over the place. They all open the Bible in different intervals. You know, they all do similar activities. How in the world do you be a witness to people? I mean, what stands out? It's the way you live your life that'll be the difference. That's what'll be the difference. People, I've become convinced, people aren't won by what you say. They're not. Because no matter how good you can say it, there's someone that can say it better. Can say it more with more of a flair. You know? They're won by how you live. They're won by seeing Jesus Christ in you and that character that you can portray every day if that's your intent and that's your focus. So, appreciate you guys having me. Want to encourage you. You know, those things aren't things to worry about. They're just a simple gut check to make sure we're not pursuing those. Let's instead press on to overcome so we'll inherit those things. Let's instead press on and see this life as a great opportunity to have a witness and to have an impact, to show the love of Christ. You know, Christ left us in charge in his stead so that we can love people all throughout the world and not be confined in one place at one time. But we're all going to leave here today and go impact the souls of men. So I encourage you to do so. Thank you.